Welcome again to Fair Conversations, part of the Mormon Faircast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of Fair Conversations, and in this episode, I'll be talking about race and Mormonism with Max Mueller. He's a PhD candidate in the study of religion at Harvard University. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. The most recent public discussion on Mormonism and race was spurred by the comments of a Brigham Young University religious education professor, which were published in the Washington Post. Professor Randy Bott related justifications for the restriction on the priesthood, which included ideas about the curse of Cain and restriction as a means of divine protection for blacks. The analogy was if you couldn't give car keys to a child, you likewise wouldn't give priesthood authority to black people for their protection. Reactions to these and other comments on the blogs and Facebook proliferated quickly, and an official response from the church came from the LDS newsroom at mormonnewsroom.org on February 29th, the last day of the month, a leap day, incidentally, and the last day of Black History Month. The statement from the newsroom read, in part, "The positions attributed to BYU professor Randy Bott in a recent Washington Post article absolutely do not represent the teachings and doctrines of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The church's position is clear. We believe all people are God's children and are equal in his eyes and in the church. We do not tolerate racism in any form. We condemn racism, including any and all past racism, by individuals both inside and outside the church." Max Mueller, a PhD candidate in religious history at Harvard University, wrote a response to the latest controversy for an online magazine called Slate. In that column, he wrote, "For many Mormons, reading Bott's words was like unearthing a theological dinosaur long thought extinct, but suddenly rediscovered in the corner of an obscure BYU office. His positions seem radically out of place in a modern church with an international membership that includes probably some 500,000 Mormons of African descent. The church's expensive and ubiquitous I'm a Mormon public relations campaign has been carefully and deliberately multi-ethnic. Mormon leaders want the world to view the religion as the diverse global community it has become. Unfortunately, Bott's beliefs, though arcane, represent a strain of Mormonism that has persisted well past the 1978 revelation." I'm joined today by Max Mueller, the author of that Slate column. Mueller's also associate editor of a forthcoming online journal called Religion and Politics, and he's currently studying in Utah. Welcome to the program, Max.
Hi, Blair. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time at such short notice to talk about this recent issue. I'd like you to start just by actually describing where you were when you first heard about Professor Bott's statements in the Washington Post, how you first came across it last week.
Yeah, well, I'm one of the few Gentiles, to use the old parlance, who belong to the Bloggernacle. I'm a blogger, occasional blogger, too occasional blogger for the juvenile instructor, so I'm happy to be a member of that that community. And a friend from that community messaged me, IM'd me with the article, and that began a day long or days long discussion about these issues. And I quickly got another email from an editor at Slate asking me to contribute, and it went from there. So I was quite shocked. Not so much shocked, unfortunately, by the sentiment, but by the fact that it came from such a person of some position and influence on young Mormon.
I mean, this is an area of research that you've spent quite a bit of time in, right?
Yes,
so right. Go ahead and talk a little bit about that, about your academic research background.
Sure. So mostly I focus on the 19th century history of these issues. And I look not only at African-American relationships with Mormons, both African-Americans' position within the church, but also national African-Americans' relationship with leading Mormons in the 19th century, but also Native Americans and how Mormons understood and related to Native Americans. So that's really where my focus is. But of course, when one does this kind of work, one is always interested in how this legacy continues today. So I am friends, and I would say a member, in fact, of a community called the Genesis Group, which is of the auxiliary, I think it's officially an auxiliary branch or auxiliary fireside.
Branch,
of the
I
LDS,
believe, yeah.
Yeah, branch of the LDS Church, started in 1971 before the priesthood ban was lifted. And so those are members, African-American members of the church who gather once a month and worship. And it's a support network for those folks. Because of it was begun before the priesthood ban to support those folks who didn't have access to the basic privileges and rights that most LDS folks, I think most non-Black, non-African in particular, and that's an important idea. I think we probably should talk about why Africa, people from of African descent had been targeted for these restrictions. But it's a support network for those folks. So I've stayed in touch with these folks and they've communicated to me frequently how they faced similar kind of rhetoric in their ward houses and, frankly, even on rare occasion in the temple, discrimination, ideas of what the church officially now calls folklore. So when my historical work obviously leads into the contemporary lives of Mormons today.
All right. In fact, what we'll do then is I'd like to use part of that press release statement that I read from just a few minutes ago in the introduction. I'd like to use that as sort of a framework to set up the rest of the discussion. The quote that we'll start with then says, "For a time in the church, there was a restriction on the priesthood for male members of African descent. It is not known precisely why, how, or when this restriction began in the church, but what is clear is that it ended decades ago." And they're referring to the 1978 declaration. So I want to begin by examining the origins. The statement says that that they do not know precisely why, how, or when, but historical research over the past probably 30 years has done a fairly good job of uncovering the origins of the ban, although there are still some ambiguities. And so I'd like to start there, as beginning with the origins of the ban, if you can take us back to sort of what the best historical records shed light on how it began.
Sure. So really credit must be given to Dr. Lester Bush, who's a medical doctor, and in the 1960s was at the time a faithful Latter-day Saint who received his medical training at University of Virginia. But in the 1960s, as a faithful Latter-day Saint in the midst of the Civil Rights era, he became quite concerned and found the church's position, which is actually not that different, frankly, from the position today, which is we don't know why it began. It left it to a matter of kind of faith. He began to research and conducted a 10-year study of LDS archives and really helped begin to compile a huge dossier of documents, of early documents. And I think he and other folks like Newell Bringhurst, who is the other really important scholar, helped to really pinpoint the moment when the priesthood ban was first articulated. Now, this isn't to say when it started, but we know when, at least when it was first articulated and when we found it in the record. And to our best, at this point, our best, the earliest reference to a ban to a person, a specific person of African descent, happened actually in winter quarters, in the spring and summer of winter quarters. There was a man named William McCary, and he had many other aliases, who was a member of the church considered an elder, but he started stirring up that obviously precarious community that had recently fled Illinois, and actually started claiming some prophetic powers and also actually claiming plural wives. And it was at this time that, from we best can tell, Parley P. Pratt, in April of 1847, said, "This man right here, because he has the curse of Ham, curse of Ham," referring to William McCary, "does not have authority and does not have the priesthood." So that is the first articulation of the ban on a particular person and referencing some kind of curse, some kind of ancient biblical, or even as will become, you know, part of the LDS understanding, some pre-mortal, sin that carried on, that black people carried in their DNA and on their skin. So that's the first reference to that. Now,
what year did you say that was?
1847.
Okay. 1847. So this is after Joseph Smith then.
This is after Joseph Smith's death. And this is, of course, you know, the church is facing an existential crisis. It is moving west, literally at the points of guns, not for the first time.
What were the places of black members before that occurred?
So, yes, let's talk about that. Let me just back up a little bit and talk about the historiography, or the history of history, as historians call it. I think it's really important to recognize that what these historians were doing, these faithful Latter-day Saints doing in the 60s and 70s, were trying to understand their church, to understand their universe, that what they understood as a universal gospel, and how it came to be not universal, but restricted, especially to a particular people from a particular continent. So in a lot of ways, it was a political or a theological project they were engaged in. And a lot of these projects worked to isolate and protect Joseph Smith from the ban and place the curse's true origins on the more acerbic, colorful, and
right.
Brigham Young. So to protect Joseph, the true, you know, originator of the Book of Mormon and the Latter-day Saint movement, isolate him, insulate him from this, historical sin of the ban. Now in Joseph's church, and I call it in my writing Joseph's church, in some ways it really certainly was, blacks did have a place. There were a few blacks, including a few ordained black men. Lewis Walker, a member and a leader of the Boston ward, was an ordained and recognized LDS elder and priesthood holder. The most famous priesthood holder, of course, was Elijah Abel, a lighter-skinned man. The Mormons called him, in other writings called him a mulatto, to use that the language of the time.
Mm-hmm.
A lighter-skinned man who Joseph knew well. It is unclear if Joseph himself ordained Elijah Abel, or if simply he recognized that ordination, a man who was sent on many missions on behalf of the church and was appointed in Nauvoo, the undertaker in Nauvoo, Illinois, a position that in fact was a little too busy in the early church or in the early Nauvoo period because of
malaria,
and I mean, this was basically a swamp area that the saints made, you know, into a livable and have a livable city, or a booming city, in fact, a very successful city. So black people were around. The person that I'm actually going to be speaking about at the church office building tomorrow in the auditorium, tomorrow night, as part of the Church History Library's Faith Series, Jane Manning James, her story I'm going to be talking about, is...
just for the record, that's March 8th, right, 2012?
Yes,
okay.
Thank you, March 8th. So probably a little too late for the plug, but I'm sure it'll be videotaped and made available online for folks. And I have the honor of Elder Snow, the future church historian, will be introducing me. So the church historians and the general authorities are interested in these issues. Obviously, could not be a better timing for this presentation. Jane Manning James was converted by missionaries in Connecticut. Charles Wandell was the name of the missionary who baptized Jane Manning, as she was called then, and members of her family. She and her members of her family, with Wandell and other missionaries, set off for Nauvoo as part of the gathering. Jane did not, and her family ended up not being able to travel with that group of saints, due, frankly, to some racism. By Elder Wandell, which actually Wandell got in trouble for by Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith actually accused Wandell of mistreating Jane and her family. Jane arrived in Nauvoo penniless, having walked some 800 miles with her family. Seven other members of her extended family had converted with her. And Joseph and Emma, as Jane tells it, welcomed them into the mansion house and housed them for a period of time. And Jane ended up staying with the Smiths, working as a washerwoman during that period. And this is probably in 1844. They arrived probably early on in 1844 and lived with Joseph for those few precious months before his martyrdom in that summer in June 1844. As Jane tells it, she was so close to the Smiths that Mother Smith, Lucy Mack Smith, invited her to hold but not examine the Urim and Thummim, as she tells it. So she touched, literally, some of the most sacred icons of the early church. Emma Hale Smith grew so close to Jane that she offered to adopt Jane as her and Joseph's spiritual child, which was not an uncommon practice. There were lots of adoptions going on, mostly for folks like Jane who did not have a spiritual benefactor, a spiritual male spiritual benefactor or protector. Jane, unfortunately, as she tells it, refused this adoption because she, as she tells it, didn't understand it. So that's how close some blacks were. Some blacks were to Joseph. But my opinion, this political project of isolating Joseph, I understand it. But I think Jane and the Mannings and Elijah Abel, Walker Lewis, and some other early Black Mormons were really more the exception to the rule, that these were rare occasions that Blacks became members of the church. And that's not to say Joseph and his early church was inherently racist or more racist than the rest of America. This is a pre-Civil War, antebellum period, when to associate with a Black person, especially a free Black person, like the saints were doing with this handful of people, was very, very dangerous for a young church that already had faced, from its earliest days, had faced persecution and ridicule and vigilante violence.
Right. Have you looked at, there's the example of a couple of church editorials, one that apparently welcomed blacks to the community and then and one that tried to backtrack from that because sure. There was criticism sure. As far as inviting, blacks into, I think, Missouri, was it?
Yes. So W.W. Phelps, he wrote a piece called Free People of Color, in which he stated that, yes, the saints would welcome blacks, only free blacks who were citizens of other states, into their community. He basically echoed, and he thought he was purposefully echoing the Missouri state constitution, which basically said the exact same thing. Missouri was a slave state, and if you, only free blacks who were citizens, I'm not sure how you get that piece of paper as a free black.
Right.
I guess you would, there's no DMV giving out free papers in this sense.
Yes.
So it's pretty unlikely to have this sort of documentation. And the Illinois actually had similar laws. But he thought he was sticking very much to the letter of the law, the Missouri letter of the law, when he wrote this editorial. the Missourians looking for an excuse, and at least in the Mormons believe, and I think it's fair to say, to dislike the Mormons, whom they feared mostly not because, well, partly because they were, exciting both free blacks and Native Americans, as the Missourians said, but worried about the Mormon voting bloc. This would be a concern, the rest of the time Mormons are in quote-unquote America before they go to the Utah Territory and even after that. So it was less the Mormons' heterodox theology, and even in my estimation, less Mormons' heterodox ideas of marriage that was a threat, but really Mormon voting bloc, this idea they would vote as a single entity.
Right. What's interesting, just to point, just a little factoid, legacy film that the church produced, which is a very faith-promoting film of the early church days, there's a part where it shows one of the Missourians sort of giving this speech against the Mormons. And it's quite interesting that he says, pretty soon, if we let these Mormons come into our place, we're going to have Mormon judges and Mormon councilmen and whatnot. These Mormons are superstitious and opposed to slavery. And so I just found it interesting that in that reenactment, that found its way as a point of emphasis right alongside the other things you mentioned, but at the same time overlooking some of the difficult things, or some of the things that we look back on now and are more uncomfortable with as far as race relations in the church at the time. But the movie does point out that the Missourians were saying, oh, they're opposed to slavery.
Sure. And then just to follow up on that, not to hold these kind of films to any kind of historical standard,
right.
But, as you Phelps printed an extra to do his Evening and Morning Star edition of Free People of Color, really once again emphasizing, no, we are not wanting free blacks to come in to the territory. And Joseph would take it one step further in the mid 1830s, writing an excoriating piece against an abolitionist, a Presbyterian abolitionist who had come into the Mormon communities and was preaching abolition. He pointed out that his citizens, unlike those in Boston at the time, who were and Boston we think of even in the 1830s as this liberal, safe place for abolitionists, William Lloyd Garrison, the African Free Society, etc. Hung abolitionists, strung them up. So he, Joseph Smith points out how civilized his community was, but how against he was the abolitionists. And the reason why Joseph was against the abolitionists was not that he was for slavery, although he did defend it, like any in this part of his life, like any good effective pro-slavery advocate, theological advocate for slavery, but because what he feared with the abolitionists was disunity, and Richard Bushman has made this point also recently, and will continue to make this point in discussions of Joseph Smith's presidential campaign. Joseph believed that what the abolitionists did was create discord among the slaves and broke up that relationship, that paternalistic relationship. So the slaves were unhappy, not because of their enslavement, but because the abolitionists were stirring them up and creating this disunity. So that's what he feared, was a disunity both within the slave quarters, but also how that would translate into national politics of discord among the regions. So that's really what his anti-abolitionists position was in the 1830s. But of course, Joseph Smith in the 1844, in his views on government, which was basically his presidential platform, when he ran for government, ran for president, in the opening paragraph of that, he said the reason he ran as a protest candidate in a lot of ways after the leading candidates, Henry Clay and Calhoun, refused to protect the Mormons from continued persecution. He wrote in that opening paragraph that the groups that had been failed the most by the American government, the groups that that had not benefited from the promises made in the Declaration of Independence, were number one, 2 or 3 million people who were enslaved because of the color of their skin, number one, and then second, the Mormons. So Joseph made, you know, established kinships with the African American slaves.
Do you see that as a political maneuver, or do you see that as a shift on Joseph Smith's part more to embrace an abolitionist cause?
There was no political upside to that position in 1844. He advocated a gradual abolitionist position, which means that the federal government would sell land in the West to purchase the slaves, so there would be no cost loss, property, you know, the wealth would not be lost.
If it was sort of political calculation.
Yes,
that was.
Yeah, no, there was no upside for Joseph to hold a abolitionist position. This was radically ahead of any kind of major political platform of the time.
What do you think led to that for Joseph Smith?
I believe it was a sincere political and since Joseph's politics were intrinsically tied to his theology, a theological position. He believed that he understood that the more his experience as a persecuted leader of a persecuted people, that he felt empathy. Empathy grew, I think, in this period of time, and was probably always there, but empathy grew for the plight of the slaves. They were not able to benefit from the Declaration of Independence and its promises, as he was not, and his people were not. So I think it was a sincere belief, and I think Joseph, in some ways, at his best, at his most universal, understanding that both his church and America together understood that rights and privileges belong, rights of the United States protected in the Constitution belong to all people, and the privileges, the restored privileges of his movement belong to all people, or it should be available at least to all people. And so that, I think, was really at the heart of his abolitionist position.
And obviously that was sort of cut short with the martyrdom, and the presidential platform came to an end at that point.
Sure.
And then you talked a little bit about that transition towards the Utah period. Before we move to that, you've also written on the restriction pertaining to more than just male ordination. In other words, it also has things to say on the subject of the restriction in gender. So I wanted you to touch on that a little bit, and then we'll shift over toward the Utah period and how things shifted at that point.
Yes, and I'd like to give a thanks to Connell O'Donovan for criticizing me lovingly. Connell is a dear friend and a fantastic researcher and writer on issues of the history of race and Mormonism. And
was he at the University of Utah? Is that?
Nope. Connell O'Donovan used to work for University of Santa Cruz, but now he's recently moved to Utah, and he's an independent researcher, but a fantastic, fantastic researcher. And he, kidded me lovingly about my Slate piece where I left out the fact that women were excluded. That was part of the editing process. Things get cut here, you know, and left on the editing floor, but that was my mistake for not picking that up. And it's part of a fundamental part of my own work is to point out that the priesthood ban is a catch-all phrase and a gendered catch-all phrase for the restrictions that were imposed on all people of African descent from, you know, as we've discussed, roughly the late 1840s to 1978. And so what does this mean for women in particular? Well, the best case, of course, to look at is Jane Manning James in this place, because she brings this to provides an archive for which we can study in some ways, or that which we can study on this issue. The restriction not only meant that black men could not hold the priesthood, but it also meant that black men and women could not be married in the temple. Black women could not enter the temple to receive sealings and ordinations. And Jane Manning James, from about 1844, that's the first letter we have, she begins a petitioning campaign towards the end of her life, wanting to have the endowments and sealings that her fellow Mormons received as a matter of course.
And she had realized later that it had been offered to her, right? I mean, according to her,
she in these letters, she presents a slew of possibilities to the church presidents, all who she knew personally, right? I mean, this is a small community, and Jane had been there since Nauvoo, right? And so she knew these people very, very well. They knew of her. She came west in 1847, September 21st or 22nd. She arrives in Salt Lake City. She is an 1847er, so she is of the elite of that pioneer class. She was the first free black person or woman, one of the first free black people in Utah. So quite a special person. So she begins a petitioning campaign, and she says, "Can I be sealed?" to Walker Lewis. I mentioned him earlier. She knew Walker briefly when he came west, but he had long been deceased, because I know he was a priesthood holder. Can I be sealed to him in proxy? Eventually, though, she does ask to be sealed to Joseph and Emma based on that 1844 offering. And for the most part, these letters went either unanswered or said, "Listen, you don't have those privileges yet as a black person," in which she understood even in the letters the limitations. Eventually, though, what I describe as a circumscribed baptism and adoption, excuse me, not a baptism, adoption occurred in 1894 when Jane was sealed to Joseph and Emma, but unfortunately not as their daughter, as she said Emma had offered, but as the Smith's eternal servitor, and that's the language the adoption records.
And what's interesting is what brought the church leaders to that point, right? There we have records of presidents of the church from Brigham Young to Joseph F. Smith and beyond trying to negotiate what sort of restriction there really was. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, this is Joseph F. Smith, who actually goes in. Joseph F. Smith and Jane have a very interesting relationship. I mean, he's the one who stands in the proxy baptism for his uncle. And he's the one, I believe, in 1908, who, after Jane's death, and I do think that's important, after her death, he finally places a vote, at least in the records that we have of the Quorum of the Twelve, places a vote before the Quorum to say, is this our official policy? It had been a practice. It had been an understood practice and an unofficial policy, and I believe it was only after Jane's death, a very visible early black Mormon, after her passing, the end of Joseph's church in some ways, did Joseph F. Smith officially make the ban, place it in front of a vote, which of course it was sustained. I don't know how much of a vote this was. It was sustained or approved by the 12 there. But, you know, these it's easy to, from our position in the 21st century, to disparage and call these men, these leaders, racists. And I think, though, they were genuinely struggling with a set of questions for which they had no answers. why are we doing this? Why are we restricting Africans? Of course, this came out of an American context. This is an American church that came out of American context, in which many Protestant and Protestant-like churches restricted African Americans from full membership or from ordination. The Mormons, though, continued on long past that was in vogue into the late 19th century and into the 20th century.
And so, before we get up to that, let's rewind a little bit to Brigham Young and the role that he played in this. And as you mentioned in some of the historiography, he's the one who's sort of implicated as the one who initiated things. And so I'd like you to talk about Brigham Young's role in the ban and some of the questions that were coming up after he became the leader of the church as the president of the 12 and then leader of the church, the LDS church that went west as president.
Sure. I don't think Brigham, this is my interpretation of Brigham to compare him to Joseph. I don't think Brigham had any inherent love for people of African descent. Although he does say Walker Lewis was a proud, after Joseph's death, he does say, I believe this is in 1846 or 1847, that Walker Lewis is an elder. He recognizes Walker Lewis as an elder.
One of the finest elders.
One of the finest elders in Boston. Mm-hmm. So at least he points out, you know, there isn't a red line for Brigham, at least at in Walker's case. Between those who are worthy and those who are not inherently. But that line becomes more and more apparent as time goes on until, of course, 1852 Utah Territorial Legislature. And you know, two things I think that motivates Brigham Young to make the ban more public and more official and more upfront. First off, he wanted to make Utah and the church a welcoming place for potential converts from the South, who would bring not only new membership, but also a great amount of wealth. The converts from the South it would be hard for those converts from the South to part from the major source of their wealth, which were the slaves they would bring. So you wanted to make Utah a welcoming place for those converts. And second of all, I think Brigham Young sincerely believed in the idea of lineage and the idea of pure lineage. And Brigham sincerely believed that those who had African blood in them had a curse, and he did not want the priesthood to be contaminated by intermarriage with blacks and whites. So he wanted to make that line quite red and quite bright red for that particular reason. So it's also really important, though, when we talk about slavery, we really should talk about the African chattel slavery second in this conversation. Brigham's first concern was also a question about slavery, was also a question with racial implications. When the Saints arrived in Utah, they entered a valley in which there was an active slave trade of Native Americans along the Spanish Old Spanish Trail running from California to Santa Fe. And the Saints found that abhorrent, that these people that the Mormons believed were the fallen, the cursed, but soon to be redeemed remnant of Jacob, Native Americans, would be treated by their brothers, right? This is one of the fundamental concepts of Mormonism or early Mormonism, is that they did not believe that Native Americans were actually a bunch of tribes that were fundamentally or racially different. They thought that was a false creation over time. So they wanted the Lamanites, the Native Americans, to unify. So they did not like the fratricide and the internal fighting, and also the selling of what the Mormons considered kin. And so the Mormons reluctantly began to participate in this slave trade, and the Mormons justified participating in the slave trade by saying they were buying these Native Americans into freedom. So in 1852, when Brigham Young legalizes African chattel slavery, although he doesn't use the word slavery because he doesn't want to draw attention to Utah, the Utah Territory, as a place where slavery is being practiced. This is in the height, of course, of the lead up to the Civil War. He uses the word servants or indentured servants or eternal servants. The territorial legislature also legalized a form of Indian slavery that by which Mormons could buy Indians and adopt them as children or marry them as wives and therefore bring them in to the Mormon fold and remove them from the hazards of this kind of slavery. So that's a really critical, I think, part of the story, that for Mormons in Utah, the Negro question, to use the 19th century phrasing, was not the real race question. It was the Indian question that the Mormons were really interested in dealing with.
There's also reports of slaves being given as tithing or in the tithing records of the church. Have you done any research on that question?
Yeah, it's pretty clear that slaves were tithed. How many is not known. The most famous, of course, is Green Flake, who was one of the first African slaves, African Americans, to enter the valley with the Vanguard Company. In July, or late July of 1847, and Green Flake belonged to the Flake family. After his master died, Green Flake belonged to Agnes Flake, William Flake, I believe it's William Flake. William Flake's widow, Agnes, acquired him, and Agnes, going west, wanted to get rid of what she says was apparently in letters this unruly slave Green Flake. Other reports indicate Green was a much more cordial person than Agnes said he was. In other places, when Agnes is in San Bernardino, she actually writes to Brigham and asks if he. Apparently she did leave behind Green Flake in Salt Lake, asked if she, who she was suffering from sickness and did not have a lot of income, if anything could be done with that Negro that she left behind, was to paraphrase her. In other words, could she get any money for him? So whether or not he was actually tithed by Agnes when she left is a matter of question. But clearly, John Brown, during the Mormon Reformation, did tithe a servant girl, an African servant girl, which he listed as worth $1,000 to the church. So there were African slaves who were tithed to the church. Now, to whom these slaves, you know, were given is a real question. It seems like that servant girl actually stayed and served the Brown family, and continued to serve the Brown family until she was emancipated after the Civil War. So there clearly was some tithing of African slaves, but the case of Green Flake is of some. You know, some question, but you know, this was property. I mean, you know, the irony of John Brown being a John Brown Mormon who's a slave owner. When we have John Brown, of course, the man who really, in some ways, starts the Civil War as the abolitionist martyr is interesting.
I also thought it's sort of strange that Elijah Abel, the name Abel rather than Cain.
Yes, yes.
is also one of those
coincidences of history, exactly.
I'd like you to speak to the issue of interracial marriage and how that played in, because you mentioned that Mormons weren't averse to interracial marriage with Native Americans or American Indians. How about interracial marriage between whites and blacks?
Yes, this was more than frowned upon. Brigham, on several occasions, said any man who marries, mixes seed, or anyone who mixes seed with an African, his blood should be spilt.
Did that play into the priesthood ban as well?
We mentioned Connell O'Donovan. Connell believes that really was the major fear, was the fear of, you know, in this case, male sexuality, right? I mean, this is really a long and trope in American history, that fear of the black, oversexed black man, you know, shows up in Birth of a Nation, in which we have actually no black people in the movie, but we have
right.
characters in blackface raping a Southern belle, only rescued by the Ku Klux Klan. So the fear of black sexuality, black male sexuality, certainly played a part in it. But again, I think Brigham Young was concerned of preserving these racial lineages. You know, this was a time when blacks were, by scientists, not only by theologians, by scientists, believed to be of a different race or an inferior race or of a cursed race. This was not some, you know, marginal view. So he wanted to protect what he considered pure lines. Now, the reason why Native Americans were marriageable, was the belief that these were actually, of course, the law members of the lost tribe of Israel, Israelites, and so this was in some ways a homecoming, a unification of chosen people. So that is, and this was one way to redeem these lost and cursed, but not permanently cursed, darker-skinned people. This was very much. And Joseph, we have some records to say that Joseph even suggested this as early, you know, in the early 1830s, that he believed that this was one of the ways that the Mormons would unite with the Lamanites, was through marriage, and intermarriage. And this would not only help end the fratricide of the Native Americans, but also make the Native Americans, through not so many generations, white and delightsome, to use the overquoted phrase from potentially unfortunate phrase from the Book of Mormon.
Okay. Now let's go over a couple of the justifications then and just sort of go through them real quickly before we fast forward a bit. So the first one we'll talk about is the curse of Cain or the curse of Ham. And these are particular readings of Old Testament texts that preceded Mormonism and that then became a part of Mormonism and were even expanded a bit through new texts that Joseph Smith revealed. So if you could talk just briefly on that idea of the curse of Cain, curse of Ham, and how they were playing out in American culture.
Sure. So both the curse of Ham and the curse of Cain were readings of Genesis, parts of Genesis, that racialized the Bible and associated those on whom either God, and as the case of Cain, the first, you know, murderer in Bible history, and then Ham, this person who uncovers his father at a moment of weakness. It's actually Noah who curses not Ham, but his progeny,
son, right?
His progeny, Canaan.
And nowhere does it say anything about skin color in these. Is that
nowhere does it say skin color? That is correct. The Bible it's a little too complicated to get into the finer kind of biblical.
Right. I'll
theory.
Post a few links to some of that research.
Sure, but you know, the Bible, I think it's wrong to completely sanitize the Bible of any kind of racial bias in this instance. But the association between these two, you know, cursed lineages was in place by the empire periods in the beginning in the 15th and the 16th centuries.
Right, and then it sort of came in with the slave trade.
Exactly, and it was
spread that.
And it was used as a justification. The slave trade was in place as these theologies, these exegesis,
right.
of the Bible were being used to justify the slave trade. Interestingly enough, these curses actually were first applied to Jews. And during,
you can even see this in some of the art, the early art.
That's right. That's correct. And you know, in some of the medieval art, we see the Ham and Cain portrayed as a classic kind of Shylock characters.
Right. The thing I want to point out, before we move on, the thing I want to point out is, for example, the mark of Cain. It doesn't say anything about skin color. In fact, the mark that God puts on Cain is a protective mark, something to prevent others from taking his life because he took the life of his brother. And so the idea of that being a restriction in regards to priesthood is simply not part of the Old Testament narrative. Is that right?
You know, the idea of a pure reading of any document, a kind of a literal reading of any document is, I think, a really difficult reading to make or reading to come up with. But I agree. What happens with any document? What happens with any whether it's the Constitution of the United States, a much interpreted document, the Bible, the Book of Mormon.
They're all appropriated, right?
What happens that these verses, these passages, these amendments in the Constitution, it's like a riverbed, and accretions upon accretions of readings through history are laid over them. So it's really, really difficult to get to the, you know, essential core truth of any particular text. So I agree that there is no obvious direct connection between Ham and Cain and Canaan and the people of African descent.
And the second thing I would add to that is even if it did, it would be problematic genetically speaking anyway, especially what we understand about genetics today. And it boils down to basically everyone or no one, either everyone or no one today would be related to those lineages if we take those lineages to be historical lineages and read the Bible in a very literalist fashion. Even if we did suppose that it was referring to black Africans, which it wasn't, for all intents and purposes, we would have to conclude that either everyone or no one was cursed, and that's simple genetics.
Yes, we're all Africans.
Right, exactly.
if we go back far enough, we're all Africans.
It's simple genetics. Okay, so the second justification that came up is a peculiarly Mormon one, and that's the idea of valiance in the pre-existence or the pre-mortal life. So the idea of fence sitters, and this is something that was the first person I saw teaching, the first record I've seen is from Orson Hyde, who gives us a sermon on this at Nauvoo before the church moves west. And then, of course, it becomes part of general church teachings through Joseph Fielding Smith later on and Bruce R. McConkie in his Mormon Doctrine book. And so this is part of what's now the church is now referring to as the folklore. Things. Jeffrey R. Holland, Elder Holland, had referred to that specifically in his interview on the PBS documentary. So that's another justification. And then this, the one from Randy Bott about the car keys, about blacks not being prepared and this being a benevolent action from God, I'm not sure I'd seen that particular argument before. Had you seen that one? The benevolent protection one?
Yes, I mean it, not in some. I've not seen the analogy of the teenage, the precoce, or you know, the
right.
the petulant child wanting
right.
the keys to the Oldsmobile.
Yes.
I hadn't seen that particular you know, kind of phraseology used. But yes, I've seen it. I mean, this explains why we have a before and after. Okay,
right.
So God, you know, saw the blacks weren't ready until 1978. Okay, now they're ready. Some kind of evolution or improvement. I'm not sure exactly how this all works, but I have seen this in other justifications. Frankly, I've seen it in African Americans have made these arguments about why there was a before and why there was an after.
Right.
I've also seen the reverse. I think this is an important one, that many Latter-day Saints believe that the church itself was not ready.
Right, as far as the church body, the members of the church who, right?
That's correct. The church members weren't ready, weren't, their hearts were not big enough to recognize these people that had been marginalized by American culture for so long to welcome them as full and equal brothers and sisters in the gospel.
Okay.
So it was, and Those arguments can actually be historicized. You know, the church barely survived Missouri, and a lot of that was much of the excuse against Mormon violence was you know, the paranoid politics, to use a famous historian's phrase, of the Missourians, that these Mormons were meddling with slaves and meddling with Native Americans. If the Mormons had, in fact, been as universal as they had hoped to be in some ways, that could have been an existential, could have produced an existential crisis for the church. I am not arguing for, justifying that, but I think, you know, that is one of the reasons why Joseph and others, and Phelps and others said, "Hey, we need to really stay away from these issues to protect to allow the church to survive."
Just for sake of time, let's fast
sure.
forward to the lifting of the priesthood restriction in 1978. As far as how you situate that within the overall history of Mormons and race.
Well, let me speak to how African-American members of the church received that news. I've talked to many, many African-Americans. Mormons, black and white, think of this day, who were alive then, as probably one of the most important days of their lives. Of course, Mitt Romney has made, you know, this moment famous on his interview with Tim Russert in 2007 on Meet the Press,
right,
when Russert pointed this question out. But this was a momentous, momentous day for a lot of the few members of the church who were of African descent in 1978. But I must say that almost to a person, there are some few exceptions. I mentioned that some African-Americans actually kind of buy into some of this belief that they weren't ready. African-Americans believe that the revelation, of course, occurred, but it was correcting the opinions of men, not God changing his mind.
Right.
God was intervening to right a wrong. I will be speaking about Jeri Harwell, who's the wife of the current Genesis Group president, Don Harwell, and she has, in her book, Leaning on Prayer, she talks about how she had a revelation. She joined the church in 77. In
wow.
77, she joined the church. She only found out that blacks had any restriction. Now, remember, she's a woman. So when
right.
she heard that, yes, men couldn't have the priesthood, she says, as she says in her book, this didn't bother me. I wasn't going to, gonna have the priesthood anyway.
Right.
But when she was told that she couldn't go on a mission, right, that she couldn't participate in that kind of rite of passage for Mormons, she was really, really hurt. Why couldn't I go and participate like my white brothers and sisters and non-other? It's not a white and black thing. We have to remember, that many other peoples of different races were welcomed into church long before you know, blacks were. So it's not just pure white church in that sense. But so it was the restriction, the revelation was correcting a fallibility, frankly, in the church itself, in the institution itself. That's how most African Americans who were members of the church understood that moment.
Okay. All right. The next question I have on that, then, here's a quote from your Slate piece. You said the 1978 revelation itself, the official declaration too, I assume, is what you're referring to, does not address why the ban was instituted in the first place, and the lack of answers from today's Mormon leaders creates a theological vacuum. What did you mean by that?
Well,
a theological vacuum.
Sure. So Mormons are faced today. This is how the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has or believes that there are prophets of God on earth. God has ordained and chosen prophets of God. And those prophets can speak to theological issues for the entire church and can receive revelation for the entire church. So church members today, because the church leadership, including President Hinckley and others, have said the official declaration to stands on its own, and we aren't going to say any more about what changed. Church members understandably want to understand what did change. So because prophets of God, today's prophets of God, the living prophets of God, do not provide answers, naturally members look to prophets of God who did provide answers, and you name some of them. McConkie, Joseph Fielding Smith. And so they look to those leaders who provided very elaborate reasons for the priesthood ban. And so it's almost natural that people want to find answers. And if today's leaders don't provide answers, members will look to yesterday's leaders to provide answers.
Absolutely. Just to tell you, I mean, I faced that same problem. On my mission, I served in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin mission, and my first area was inner city Milwaukee, and the missionaries were the only white people, you know, in the area, and I had that question really hit home to me. I grew up in Utah, and so, you know, I hadn't really had to face that question until I was there on my mission, and I found an old, there was a talk that was being photocopied and sent around, the talk by Alvin Dyer that speaks to the issue of premortal valiance and things, and I was really uncomfortable with it. I remember feeling like I wouldn't ever want to tell anybody that. It seemed to sort of explain a little bit. I don't want to say that it seemed entirely implausible, but it was really all that I had to go with. But I was terribly uncomfortable with it, and so that the idea of the theological vacuum still existing, and those talks still circulating, and they do, and I don't know how prevalent those ideas are, but to hear Professor Botts relating some of those things in a national newspaper, you know, I had heard them as recently as 2002 myself, not across the pulpit, not in any church meeting, but those ideas are still around, still floating around, and that theological vacuum still exists because, you know, the church hasn't ever made an official statement. In fact, the most recent one says we don't know, and you know why it started. So I want to return to that official church statement to get your next to give you your next question.
Sure.
It says some have attempted to explain the reason for this restriction, but these attempts should be viewed as speculation and opinion, not doctrine. The church is not bound by speculation or opinions given with limited understanding. First, I thought that was interesting, limited understanding. That seems to be a direct reference to Bruce R. McConkie's sermon that he delivered to religious educators after the ban was lifted and said, forget everything that we ever said about this issue. We spoke with a limited understanding. And of course, he went on to still leave some of these same racial ideas in his Mormon Doctrine book and subsequent publications, and his sermon wasn't delivered to the church as a whole, and so I don't know exactly how far it reached. But the recent church statement says the church is not bound by speculation or opinions, and that these things are speculation and not doctrine. So as a historian, in analyzing this statement sort of from a cultural perspective, given your background in the history, what sticks out to you about the way that this response was phrased?
Well, I'm frustrated with the response. I think – so when Brigham Young said – in 1852 that no man having the seed of Cain in him shall have the priesthood, if no other prophet has said it before, I'm saying it now, to paraphrase him, he was speaking as a prophet, the leader on earth, and speaking as the kind of spiritual leader, certainly, right. Certainly too. Joseph Fielding Smith, who I think most people would recognize was the most important theological leader of the 20th century, wrote an extended treatise on why the ban was in place and printed in many editions starting in 1931, but it went through many printings, called The Way to Perfection. He was writing as a church historian there. And so obviously that office, which is a official office, which was established literally at the first day of the church, as part of the revelation that established the church. So that office has some authority to it. And then, of course, he was president of the church very late in his life. These leaders were speaking, I believe, with authority. I don't believe they were saying these are my rationale, my speculation. First of all, they were writing these treatises, but they were also referring back to prior presidents and prophets who had made similar arguments. So this was, a building not only of, these prophets were not only speaking for themselves, I believe, I would say, as leaders of the church and folks who have authority to speak on such matters, but also saying, hey, this is not an inconsistent position with the prophets who have come before us. So I don't believe that those leaders were speaking, were speculating. I don't believe the leaders believed, at least, they were speculating. So that's why I find that phrase troubling. The idea of limited knowledge, I think I give that a little bit personally. I react to that with a little more sensitivity and empathy. I think we are all subject we are humans, so we're all subject to failures and limitations. And the church is I'm saying this personally, but I'm also kind of hoping to channel some of the Black Mormons that I know here, that the church is, as Jerry would say, a denomination. It is run by men, and therefore the church is suspect to men's failures. So God's intervention, direct intervention in 1978 to correct these men, I think is something that is more kind of palatable and salient, both for a historian and also for members of the church.
And I should add too, before we move on, that there also will be some members who will want to say that will want to say that they don't want to come down either way on whether God started the priesthood restriction. I think all Mormons, all believing members of the church, can agree that he ended it. There's still disagreement about whether he started it, whether God started it or not, and I think that the preponderance of historical information — this is a personal belief — the preponderance of historical information seems to me to indicate what the person you referred to said, as far as prophets not being omniscient and prophets being people who bring their ideas with them to their role of prophethood. And that sort of puts the church in a difficult spot. It's in this is the question that I want to raise about that. It's become somewhat cliche, I think, within Mormon studies to say that Mormons typically emphasize orthopraxy over orthodoxy, or correct practice over correct belief. Do you think that this issue on blacks in the priesthood seems to be one that shows some of the problems with that distinction as far as where beliefs and practice sort of meet?
Well, it was a practice to exclude African Americans, and it was an orthodox belief, at least prior to 1978, that supported that practice. Emphasizing practice is fine. I mean, in religious studies, as you well know, because it's been, scholars like Robert Orsi and others have said, because it's been religious studies comes out of a liberal Protestant tradition, that belief more than practice is emphasized and studied and prioritized. Mm-hmm. And Mormons practicing their faith, whether that's a 7 days a week requirement of some sort of the church, whether that's in the home or elsewhere, certainly, Mormons do, but also Mormons believe things. And I think that is essentially important. Mormons do things because Mormons believe certain things. Their actions, their practice, is a result of belief. And that includes limiting the gospel before 1978, excluding people of African descent. If I may, just to move a little bit forward here, this is where, this is the argument I'm going to make tomorrow night in the center of Mormonism in some ways, which will be kind of awkward for a white, non-Mormon man to be talking about in the 21st century, to talk about a 19th century black Mormon woman. There could not be more, at least superficially, differences between us. And that's why I rely on Black Mormon women to tell her story in a lot of ways. Here's kind of my stake, my personal stake in this matter. And I've said this to many Mormons, and I say it, and it happens to be true. I love a lot of Mormons, genuinely love them. I'm close to a lot of them. I'm fond of them, and I have a great respect for the church. I believe that since 1978, no religious community in the world has done more to reach out to people of African descent, both with the hand of fellowship and a humanitarian hand. Now, obviously, both of those are problematic in and of themselves.
Right.
But it's out of love, and actually, I'd say, out of a sense of reparation for past I would even say guilt for not having done that before, that the church is so active and sincerely active in Africa and the African diaspora. I happen to be teaching high school French to the Cajuns, a Yankee teaching French to the Cajuns down in southern Louisiana during Katrina and Rita. And I was in Lafayette, so I was not hit by Katrina, at least by the storm, but we certainly were hit by the population of New Orleanians coming to our city. Our city, Lafayette, literally doubled overnight. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with their yellow T-shirts on, were there before the state government, were there before the federal government, were there before the local government could even figure out what had happened.
Sure.
It warms my heart and brings tears to my eyes to see people from northern Louisiana and Texas and other places empty the bishop's storehouse and bring pallets of food and water and clothes and love to mostly African Americans who were displaced and living in Lafayette's Cajun Dome in the early days of the church. So here's my point, and my kind of political point. I think it's fair to be clear about one's kind of politics. I want this church, and I joked about how demanding this church is, that it's a seven-day-a-week church, as I believe Elder Packer said in this last general conference, and it should be a seven-day-a-week church. This church demands a lot from every member. It's hard being a Latter-day Saint. It requires a lot. You get a lot out of it, I believe. You get a lot out of it. You have a testimony of faith. You have great community. You believe that your family is sacred and will be with you forever, as will your entire, in some ways, your entire community. You have people you can turn to in your most dire moments of life. I hope for those people who commit their lives to this church, who show that very Mormon thing, show the agency to embrace the Mormon gospel and receive that testimony of faith and have a testimony of faith. I want to have as few barriers to peace and happiness in their place as possible. It's hard enough being a Latter-day Saint not to have to deal with this remnant racism that still is taught and whispered and sometimes even reported on from in a major national publication, and it maybe is whispered in office hours by a BYU professor who teaches 10% of the university and teaches missionaries. It's hard enough. So that's what I hope, why I believe that stories of early Latter-day Saints, pioneers like Jane Manning James and Elijah Abel and others, these stories are not peripheral to the Mormon experience. They are central. They are, as I say, if Mormonism is partly about being persecuted because chosenness, as it said in the book, as it says in First Nephi, persecution is a mark of chosenness, then black people have been doubly persecuted and are doubly, right, therefore Mormon. And so these stories are not peripheral but central to the history of Mormonism, and should be, Jane and Elijah should be counted among the pantheon of a modern, pantheon of early Mormon pioneers.
One thing I want you to quickly touch on, because we're almost out of time, but sure, the idea of racism is not necessarily being something that's overt and obvious and extremely mean-spirited, especially sort of latent racism that we might see today. When people hear the term, "Oh, that's racist," it can seem they can take it the wrong way. Does that make sense?
No, I think that absolutely makes sense. I mean, we are all humans, and we are all fallible, and we all have prejudices. This is how our mind sorts through the world and makes decisions quickly. Professor Bott, I'm not going to, his comments were very, very problematic, and what I believe it is very possible that he's a lovely human being. Unfortunately, I don't know any better than to read his comments. Yes, speaking to that point, trying to answer your question directly, racism, it often is about ignorance. Racism comes out of ignorance. And so when people have a limited knowledge, people are going to make limited experiences with other people of other races. People are going to use the knowledge they have. And so racism does not have to be an act of violence, a rhetorical or physical act of violence. Racism can be subtle, and racism can be simply an act of ignorance.
Right.
When someone asks a Sunday school teacher in an LDS ward, why did the priesthood ban? Why was there a priesthood ban? That Sunday school teacher has, to make a choice. He can say, "Well, I don't know," or "We don't know," or that Sunday school teacher can use the limited knowledge that he has, or speak to the things he has read or she has read, and that can be quote unquote racist if what he says is derogatory to you know, African Americans or people of other races. But racism is mostly, almost always about ignorance, about other. And what's so great about the LDS Church and why the church deserves more credit than it's allowing itself to receive in a lot of ways is that it puts young men and young women in contact, in very, personal contact, trying to make these people members of their own community from an early age. 19, 20-year-old men, 23, 24-year-old women going out into the world and making contact with people who are almost always very different from them. And so those points of contact are opening these young people's eyes and hearts and minds to others. And, you know, you probably had a mission in Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
I bet your heart is still in Milwaukee. And I know
that was my favorite city.
Exactly. And I know, that missionaries who go to Africa or other places, they love these places and these people. And so they come back and share that love and tell the world, their Mormon worlds and the rest of the world about these places because they have intimate contact. And that's what's powerful about the missionary experience. So I think through the missionary experience, a lot of this ignorance about others, racial or otherwise, national or otherwise, will be, eradicated because of these points of contact. And that is very, very powerful. But nevertheless, I believe that unless the church speaks from the top on the issues of race, Mormons of all races and nationalities will continue to struggle to find answers, and they will use the answers that they have. And it's a poor set, in my mind, a poor selection from which they can draw.
Yeah, I think it just boils down to something needing to be said from a specific leader in a specific official context. I'm glad that the newsroom released a fairly explicit statement. I know not every church member follows the church newsroom, and so.
Yes, I mean the church newsroom, and I have a lot of respect for the folks who work in the church newsroom and public affairs, and I speak with them on a fairly regular basis. And I expressed to them that after Professor Bott's comment that a press release from their office isn't for many Mormons isn't sufficient, partly because the public affairs office is not a prophet of God and therefore doesn't have that kind of authoritative weight. I believe,
and I think awareness too, just general awareness.
Exactly.
People, I think more Mormons are likely to tune into General Conference than check up on the newsroom. I just think that's just the way that Mormons operate. Not to take away from what the newsroom does. Yeah. I know they work hard there and they do quite a bit of things there. It's just a matter of where the attention of the members are directed seems to be more likely to official church publications and General Conference than it is to that newsroom.
Yes. I think it would be a great gift, and I think that gift is that miracle, as one prominent Black Mormon said to me, that miracle day when a church apostle or even the president makes an official statement on this issue. To repudiate not necessarily the past leaders themselves, but the ideas. I think that could be that is possible. I think that day is coming. And
yeah, it seems they've made a beginning here with this, yes. Especially with this church, this latest statement from the newsroom that does refer to the things, at least the specific things that Professor Bott said as being not church doctrine today. One thing I'd like you to touch on for the last question before we go is the public affairs statement does say, as I quoted at the top of the interview, the church's position is clear. We believe all people are God's children and are equal in God's eyes and in the church. We do not tolerate racism in any form. We condemn racism. This is the interesting part that stuck out to me, I think, most. We condemn racism, including any and all past racism, by individuals both inside and outside the church. What sort of reactions? You mentioned a few, but I hope we could just close on a couple of reactions that you were able to interact with Black members of the church there, and the sort of things that they've expressed to you when they read that statement.
Well, you know, generally, I think the folks that I talked to, almost to a person, were hoping that the power of that statement, I mean, it's very powerful. It's a step towards repudiating the past racist positions of members inside and outside, you know, members inside the church and the world, and, you know, the world outside the church. But again, that statement is as powerful as it is, really has no authority unless an apostle's name is attached to it. If an apostle's name had been attached to that church, we would be talking about we wouldn't be talking about this subject, I don't believe. And I use that word carefully, it would arm Latter-day Saints, Black, white, all races, when issues, when discussions of prevalence, fence-sitting, curse of Cain, curse of Ham, come up in Sunday school, at a church picnic, that they could simply raise that piece of paper or that statement because ex-apostle said it or the president put his name on it and say, look, the president or the apostle said this. And so therefore, what you just said is wrong, and the apostle or the president has said it so. I believe that day is coming, but until that day comes, you know, the public affairs can write all those kinds of press releases. But unless an apostle's name is attached to it, it does not have the weight. And that was the disappointment that a lot of Black Latter-day Saints that I talked to had about it. They were pressed with the statement. It was certainly the statement that has gone the farthest, and it makes sense that it goes the farthest since, frankly, you know, Bott's statement has raised, you know, the biggest kind of raised this issue to the fore in Mormonism, to the point not seen since, really, since Revelation itself. So it was an appropriate statement. The only thing that I think Black Latter-day Saints and White Latter-day Saints who care about these issues, and I think most do, if an apostle or the president's name had been attached to that statement, this would be a different conversation.
I think so, and I think members who are following the newsroom, I think, are aware that there are apostles that are involved in you know, helping make decisions at that level. It's just it would bring that extra portion of authoritative heft to it,
yes.
To sort of put an apostle's name and face to that. And well, Max, I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're busy. You're currently, like I said, you're a PhD candidate, religious history at Harvard. How much longer do you have to go until you're done with that?
It'll be done when it's done, but most likely now, I'm going to be continuing to write these next – probably two more years. Let me try to answer that question.
Yeah,
two more years. You hear that, advisors? Two more years. But it's an exciting project. And I think one that isn't telling a story of simply of racial exclusion, because that's not the true story of Mormonism. It's not simply a story of Mormonism as a quote-unquote racist church. It's not. The history of Mormonism at race, both with African Americans, Native Americans, and other peoples, is often one of kinship due to persecution. And so I think that story also needs to be told, particularly during this political season when Mormonism is saddled with this racist label.
All right. Thanks a lot, Max.
Thank you, Blair.